You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the Children's Program for Reluctant Adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. We're all sheltering in place in the neighborhood during the coronavirus pandemic and keeping our social distance. So today's show is originating from Mr. Jones's home, where there's more Passover matzah than toilet paper. Fortunately, we have a microphone, an internet connection, and a computer running Skype, which means we can still have guests on the program who are also sheltering in place and keeping their distance. On today's show, our guest is Julia Stoops, author of the novel Parts Per Million from Forest Avenue Press. Julia is a recipient of Oregon Arts Commission fellowships for visual arts and literature, and she was a resident at the UCross Foundation in 2016. She holds dual degrees in visual art and photography and received an MFA in painting from Portland State University. Julia has experience in alternative radio news journalism at Portland's KBOO Community Radio, you might know it, as well as a background in teaching media studies, visual art, and the history of ideas. She's a native of New Zealand and now makes her home here in Portland, where she was a member of the Pinewood Table Writing Group. Portland's also the setting of Parts Per Million, Julia's debut novel, and a finalist for the Penn Bellwether Prize for socially engaged fiction. In the words of writer and political activist Robert Newman, Parts Per Million effortlessly weaves the personal with the political in this relentless page-turner. Part psychological thriller, part hard-boiled noir, her characters are fresh, real, and alive, with a lightness of touch and an uncanny ear for great dialogue. Julia Stoops tells the story of four activists in a time of war, their moral and emotional conflicts, their betrayals, and their small acts of heroism. Parts Per Million reads like the bastard offspring of Graham Greene and Naomi Klein. Julia Stoops, welcome.
Thanks very much, Ken. It's really fantastic to be here.
Now, we should tell the listeners that you're somewhere else. I'm at home recording this because we're living in the time of our sheltering in place during the coronavirus pandemic. So let's start off. How are you holding up? Are you able to get work done? I know we're all feeling extremely weird, and some of us have been hit pretty hard in terms. I know I have friends who have lost jobs and things like that.
Yes, indeed. So far, I feel very fortunate. The place where I work at, we're able to work from home fairly easily, and we have people work from home there, you know, maybe one day a week and so on. So now we've all transitioned to working from home, and we keep in touch over Slack and, of course, email and other things like that. We have, you know, Zoom conferencing set up and so on. So it's, so far it's going, is going relatively smoothly for me, and I feel grateful for that. And spring is coming, and, you know, there's just, it looks beautiful outside and so on. I do, my heart goes out to the people who have lost their jobs so quickly. I mean, just so many people suddenly have become unemployed, and you know, there are other people who are immunocompromised, and they're fearful of contact and so on. So, yeah, it's definitely a time of great uncertainty, but I have to say right now, I am doing fine. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Now, before we get to the novel, let's go into a little background. You started in visual arts rather than writing, and you have an incredible portfolio that listeners can browse on your website, juliastoops.net. And some of those pieces go back over 20 years. Were you also writing at that time or doing visual art exclusively?
Yeah, I was always a visual artist, and that's my first love. It was my, you know, I went to college very, very young as a visual artist, and I've had an exhibition career for quite a long time now. I would say probably 30 years at this point, my website doesn't go back that far because you've, you know, at some point you've got to curate the old stuff out.
Right.
Yeah. And so it was a huge surprise to me. Let me see. It was, I think, 2001 when I suddenly got a writing bug, because I never considered myself to be a writer. I didn't have any ambition to be a writer. I didn't have any sense that I was a writer. I've always been able to write things like proposals and stuff like that. You know, I've always had like a fairly good command of sort of, you know, just written language and so on. But I never considered myself to be a fiction writer. I didn't have any desire to be a fiction writer. I didn't really have a story to tell in that kind of narrative way. And then suddenly I got a sort of compulsion to write down a story that was kind of stuck in my head. And I didn't really know what to do with this for a while. And then one day I started typing it out. I literally started just typing out the story that was in my head. And I found that the pieces that I typed out were no longer stuck in my head going round and round and round. So I figured, well, maybe I'm supposed to just get this out, this whatever this thing is. And this was in 2001. So it was actually before the novel is set. The novel set in 2002, 2003, but the story arc I laid down in 2001 in this strange, feverish sort of compulsion to sort of vomit up this story that was in my head, and I just really didn't know what to do with it.
And that was Julie, I'm sorry, I just want to set the time period. So that was a reaction to 9/11 and kind of everything that happened after that.
Yeah, kind of that post 9/11, just very strange time, you know, reaction to just the sort of the shutting down of critical thinking that was happening. And if you think just, you know, very few years before that, in 1999, there was really quite an uprising among activists, you know, who were becoming very aware of what was happening in the global South. And there was a real sense of activism gaining some traction. You know, if you think about the WTO protests and shutting down the WTO, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then all that stuff became very difficult to do, and activists really sort of hunkered down after 9/11 because dissent became really very suspect. And so I was reacting to that. I was very troubled by that because I felt like it was the beginning stages of a sort of fascistic mindset and a fascistic state. And this was during the height of the Bush administration. So I wrote the story in response to that. And then I didn't do anything with it for about a year because I didn't even tell anybody that I'd done this because I literally had no mental model into which to place this thing that I'd done. It was like I just had this little secret garden that I dug, and I didn't tell anybody because, you know, no one thought I was a gardener. But then after a while, you know, I literally just sort of put it in a drawer kind of thing. Well, you know, it was on my hard drive. And after a while, about a year, I thought, well, maybe I did that for a reason. Maybe I should do something with this. And so I knew that it was not crafted well, just because I knew I didn't have fiction writing craft skills. And so I thought, well, maybe I need to kind of clean this up and see if I can do something with it. So I joined a writing critique group, and that was in 2002.
And that was the Pinewood Table.
That was the Pinewood Table, yes, led by Stephen Allred and Joanna Rose. And that writing critique group is still going. It's awesome. Everything I learned about the craft of fiction writing, I learned at that table, and that, you know, we meets weekly and, you know, like looks at all kinds of things like language and point of view and structure and all kinds of good stuff. And so I learned a lot. It was a really, really fantastic learning experience. So during those years, I didn't do that much visual art when I was really, you know, editing the novel. It was like many, many years of revisions and edits and so on. And then the effort to get it published also is like another story. But then once all that was done, I've returned to visual art, and I do really feel like visual art is my first love. And so writing the novel was a little bit like having an affair, you know. it was crazy and wild and different and exciting. But then I returned back to my first love, visual art.
I was wondering, you had kind of the story in your head, and you mentioned the word compulsion in terms of having to get it out. How did it come out as writing rather than a visual art, which was the art form you were most familiar with?
I sat down and I typed. I didn't really write longhand very much. It was more kind of typing, and it was a sense of like this, like a movie playing in my imagination, and I just described what I saw. Do you know what I mean? So I just typed
yes.
out, you know, like sort of as it was happening. I should say at the same time, I was exploring a character in my visual art, and it was this character who is standing in a desert, and he's wearing a suit, and he looks like he's waiting for something to happen, and he's just sort of standing there as if he is perhaps lost or stunned, or maybe just like on the edge of you know, understanding that something's about to happen. And this everyman character kept appearing in my visual art at the time, and he did get woven into one of the main characters of my novel,
and that's John Nelson.
So he was explored in this sort of abstract symbolic way visually, but when I was doing those paintings, I wasn't really thinking, you know, this is Nelson. It was like Nelson sort of grew out of that symbol, and Nelson became this person who was very clearly defined in terms of having a history and a personality and, you know, intentions and motivations and things like that.
Now, I did,
so there was some overlap.
Yeah, I did look on the website and saw those art pieces of the character that became Nelson. And you described him on the website, and I'm quoting here, an everyman figure and the principal character in my novel who is struggling and disillusioned and unsure of which path to walk upon. He stands in chaotic spaces and sometimes interacts or fails to interact with small blue objects and lights that float around him. There's frustration and even despair with hints of hope, perhaps a reflection of living through the early 21st century's political changes. Now, oddly enough, I felt that was a big theme of the book. So,
that's exactly the theme of the book. And Nelson is sort of right there experiencing that kind of almost in real time. He's this person who, you know, he still believes on some level that the positive democratic structures that were put in place by earlier generations still work as they were meant to, and basic institutions designed to protect ordinary people hadn't been gutted, and so on. That this idea that sort of what's right and fair will ultimately prevail because society is rational and has checks and balances and so on. So he still believes that, you know, in 2002. And there's something towards the beginning of the book where, you know, the characters hear President Bush declare what was called the doctrine of preemptive strike, just this idea that the United States is allowed to basically go to war against a country, not because the country has declared war or done an act of aggression or anything, but just in case they might, which is what they did, you know, what we did with Iraq, you know, went to war with Iraq just in case they might go to war with us.
And of course, there was a bunch of what was proved to be false reports of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Exactly. Yeah, it was all just made up baloney. So so there's this piece near the beginning of the book where they hear this over the radio, and Nelson's just like baffled. He's just like he's like, no way, that's against international law. You know, the UN wouldn't let him, right? And so this is sort of like the, you know, the part of, like, I think the hinge of the early 21st century was like this crumpling of certain edifices that seemed like they were going to last for a long time. And so he's living through that. And he's, you know, I tried really hard in the novel to not be
dogmatic or.
Yeah, like not be preachy, not be dogmatic, not have any character say, you know, use monologues to express complex political ideas, because people don't really talk like that. You know, I really wanted the dialogue to be very realistic. So there's no long paragraphs that describe, you know, what's going on in any sort of like editorial way or anything, but it's just the background of what's happening. It just seeps into their lives. You know, there's like snippets of things on TV and snippets of things that people say, and you know, they'll glance at a newspaper headline here and there and so on. And so it's all part of that kind of background noise of what the characters are dealing with it and how hard that is to deal with, because, you know, it's hard to understand it at the time that it's happening. It just doesn't seem quite believable, you know?
Now, I want to get to some of the other characters too, but first, when you first started at the Pinewood Table with Joanne and Stephen, what did the story look like? Was it much different from the final version, the book that I read?
I would say it was very different, yes. It was very different. One big difference is formally the draft that I brought to the Pinewood Table was all written in like third person omniscient point of view. So like, you know, me, the narrator, saying, you know, he did this, she did that.
Right.
The kind of thing. And that was just because that was the only way I knew how to write. You know, I had never studied fiction. I'd never studied creative writing. I'd never even studied like literature. I was always into, you know, when I did my BA, I was more into sort of philosophy and linguistics and so on. So I knew I was very green. And so I brought this, you know, rather clunky green, green as in undeveloped, not green as in environmental. It was green also. novel to the table. And so one of the big changes that happened was I explored writing from specific points of view in voice. And that was something that they really encourage people to explore. So writing from the point of view and in the voice of different characters, and also writing in scenes. So the idea of writing, you know, like each chapter is a scene, it's a short scene, and there isn't that much kind of narrative description going on. There's a little bit from one of the characters, Fetzer, who his point of view is from the past. So he's first person, but he writes from the past. Like he narrates his stuff as, you know, because it happened in the past. And so he, you know, he sometimes fills in with like little bits of commenting about like, we thought it was this, but we realized it was that, or, you know, some kind of description. But the other two, Nelson and Jen, are both in the present. And so we get them kind of in real time. And so, you know, each chapter is a scene. Jen particularly is very, she's first person present. So and that sort of fits her personality, because she's impulsive and she's quick and she's kind of irritable and so on. And so we just get her almost sort of like, not quite stream of consciousness exactly, but, you know, we get her thinking her thoughts just as she's thinking them, and so on. And Nelson is also first person. He's also in the present, but he's third person.
He's third person present, yes.
Third person present, yeah, because he, of all the characters, he's the least grounded, because he starts out the novel in the state of crisis. And so I felt like putting him in third person instead of first person was a way of adding a little bit of distance to his character, a little bit of a disconnect, even though it's a very standard way to write. Like, it's not an unusual way to write or anything. It just makes him a little bit less, you know, you're not quite as sort of centered in the character when you're in his scenes as you are in with the other two main characters.
Yes, it gives a little distance.
Yeah.
Now I read that, Julie, originally, well, those, of course, are the three major characters in the book. There were two others I read that you also had narrating. So there were chapters from their points of views. There's Deirdre, who plays a big part in the book, and Frankie, a little bit of a lesser character in terms of the narrative. So you also had chapters from their points of view in the first few drafts?
I did, yeah. When I first started exploring writing in voice and scene, I had five point of view characters, five voices, and indeed, Deirdre and Frankie both had points of view. And Frankie was more, he had bigger visibility in the novel than he does now. His visibility gradually decreased in the novel. And part of it was because I ended up writing something that was way too long and I just had to cut stuff out. And so Frankie, I ended up dropping his point of view pretty early on because he turned out to be very difficult for me to write. It was hard for me to inhabit Frankie.
Oh, why was that? Just he was so different from your own personality or people that you've known?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. He's kind of like a little bit of comic relief in a way, because he's kind of like this goofy guy, and
kind of like a sidekick in
he's kind of like a
movie.
Sidekick. Uh-huh. Yeah, it just didn't seem necessary to have his point of view in the story. So
that fourth character, Deirdre, that was a little tougher to remove
when
her
from
the narrative.
When I let go of her voice, I mourned letting go of Deirdre because she's a very important character in the novel, and her voice was it was different from the others. Not just because she's from a different country, she's from Ireland and so on, but also she's in a very different place in her life. She's essentially adrift, and she sees the world through aesthetic eyes, you know, and so she had this kind of drifty, meandering, quite lyrical, poetic voice. And it was also full of tragedy because she has tragedy in her past, and that's becomes, without giving too much away, her undoing, or the lack of resolution of that becomes her undoing. And so she was a pretty fascinating character to write, and I really enjoyed her point of view. And also she doesn't take for granted, because she's new in the household, she doesn't take for granted the things the others take for granted. So she was a really good vehicle for explaining, you know, just things like the habits of the others and what they look like and what it's like to live in that household and what the household looks like, and, you know, and so on. And so, because they all take it for granted, they've lived there for years, they've lived with each other for years, and they're not about to like start, you know, explaining in detail, because you're in their heads, you know, they're not really narrating a story to the reader, they're thinking inside their heads. So taking her point of view out was a real challenge, because I had to then somehow get a lot of her descriptive stuff where she's describing their world, you know, just the physicality of their world. I had to get it on the page in other ways without making my characters suddenly start explaining to the narrator, you know, like what things look like and what it's like to wake up in this household, and, you know, that there's like fabric tacked up on the windows because they can't afford curtains and so on. So, but I took out her point of view because it was upstaging everybody else. And that became an issue. You know, I felt like her story was one I could write a novel about, but I didn't want to. I'd started out writing a novel about these activists. I didn't want it to be a novel about a woman who had experienced a certain kind of tragedy and that had nothing to do with, you know, activism or the state of the world or anything. And I could see the novel becoming that, and I just didn't want to write that novel. It wasn't what I had started out doing, and it wasn't really what I was committed to. So in order to kind of save the novel, I removed her point of view, and that was like a really, really hard choice, a very hard choice.
Now, one advantage I think as a reader is by removing her point of view, and of course I didn't see those early drafts, I think you add some mystery to her character, and that mystery becomes a big part of the narrative. There's a lot we don't know about her. There's hints throughout her story, and then things become a little bit clearer as the novel progresses. But I thought that was really beneficial as a reader in terms of the entire plot. And I guess your main reason was she was kind of dominating the story if we had her chapters told from her point of view.
Yeah, yeah. And I agree. I think the mystery is good. I tried to keep her mysterious even when she was in there. Like, she, you know, the thing that happened to her, I never have her sort of like I never had her describe it in you know, explicit logical detail or anything like that. But she certainly does become more mysterious when her voice is removed. And I think that ends up working because she is as mysterious to the reader as she is to her housemates. Like, they never really figure out who she is. And
there's
actually
a major, without saying too much, there's a major reveal about her towards the end that her housemates never knew about.
Yeah. And so this is like a big bombshell that you know, they come to understand something about her. And I wanted that to be, I think it works better for that to be a bombshell for the reader as well as the people she was living with. And that makes you kind of feel like you're there with them.
Now, when you mentioned Deirdre as kind of her story is a tragic story, you make her a scholar of ancient Greek philosophy and literature, especially the plays of Sophocles, Aeschylus. So kind of Aeschylus, I think, is regarded as the father of tragedy on stage. And the plays at that time had themes relevant to the time of the book, post 9/11 America. In other words, the need, say, for an individual to go against the actions of a state. The futility, perhaps the dire consequences that result. Were you using that to compare the situation in those ancient Greek plays to the present of the novel, that post 9/11 world?
I'm so glad you picked up on that, because I, you know, there's nothing in the book that draws any kind of direct connection like that. But indeed, that idea that these are huge questions the characters are grappling with, and they have to do with, you know, the individual and the greater good, and the idea that these things are kind of universal and they've never gone away. And
going back thousands of years.
yeah. And Deirdre has a point of view that's kind of like more, she's more stepped back. She's more, you know, she has this idea of like, well, you know, if all the people in the world disappeared, the weeds would take over, and wouldn't that be kind of delightful or something? As it was one place where she and Nelson are talking about that, and Nelson, you know, the environmental activist, is kind of like, you know, because he's grounded in sort of science and the here and now and the present day and solutions and all that kind of stuff. And so she's got that sense of almost nihilistic distance, which definitely comes from, or is certainly informed by her knowledge of like the Greek tragedies and so on. Yeah, so awesome. I'm so glad you mentioned that.
well, thanks. I did a little a background check on Sophocles and Aeschylus, because I haven't read them in a while. But what was the play about? Oh, Antigone, where she buried her brother, even though he was considered an enemy of the state and then was punished accordingly. You're listening to Mr. Jones's Neighborhood on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking while sheltering in place with Julia Stoops, author of the novel Parts Per Million from Forest Avenue Press. Now, I was also interested, you pared down the point of view, so we've got just the three main characters rather than five telling the story and alternating chapters to do that. But there was one kind of great quote that I read Stephen Allred came up with when he read your early drafts. He said, "You haven't written a novel, you've written a miniseries." So what did he mean? Was the novel too long? Was there too many subplots, digressions?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, one of the things that happens when you join a writing critique group is you bring pages to the table each time you meet, and you read them out, and people give you feedback and so on. And so one of the pieces of feedback that I would get often was, you know, "That's really interesting, unpack it." And so I unpacked and unpacked and unpacked and unpacked, and I ended up with this. I mean, at some point, I think the novel was probably at least double the length that it is now, maybe even more than that.
Wow, and it's not a short novel as it is. It's about 360 pages.
Yeah. It was kind of huge. And so this is problematic for a person who is trying to get published and they're not already, you know, a bestseller, blockbuster bestseller. Is, you know, a debut novelist can't publish a huge novel. It's too much of a risk. It takes too much to print it. Like the printing cost is too high, and the amount of space it takes up on bookshelves is too high, and so on. And so publishers won't touch debut novels that are huge. And even the length that it is like, you know, right at that edge of like not quite publishable for a debut novel. I mean, to me, it looks like a normal size, but so yeah, I had this thing that was way too big after all that unpacking. I'm talking like 7 years worth of, you know, writing critique group, 7 years worth of unpacking. And so everybody had a backstory. Everybody had, there were other characters in there. You know, Deirdre wasn't the only person who worked at Mr. Nguyen's diner, for instance. There were other people, you know, like there was all of these other things happening and so on. And I ended up having to remove quite a bit to get the book to a publishable length.
Was that a difficult decision to remove those? I think in retrospect, for me at least, it kind of adds depth to the characters, because there's hints of the backstories for each characters, but of course you're not spending a lot of pages on going into what those backstories are. But each character has a past, and I think that's clear to the reader, and that pretty much determines the way they react to the events in the narrative, in the story.
Yeah, I think doing all that extra work enriched the story. Because like you say, there's hints that come through. The characters are more, you know, there's a lot more details to the characters than what you get as a reader. But those details inform, you know, these sort of very, very well fleshed out human beings with certain motivations and limitations and fears and desires and so on. So I think all the work I did that ended up getting removed was beneficial. There were certain things that were hard to remove, but I would say the hardest part was when I removed so much, the hardest part was more kind of technical, making sure the pieces that remained flowed together in a way that was understandable by the reader. Because when you remove stuff, sometimes you still have to, you might remove a whole chapter, but you have to make sure that you put in one or two lines of connective tissue that do the job of making, you know, the following chapter make sense.
Oh, no,
sense.
I can give you an example, and you could tell me if this was something that you did take out. For example, the oldest character of the three, and they have this environmental media group called Omnia Mundi, which means all the world in Latin, is Fetzer, or Irving Fetzer is his full name, and he turns 50 during the events of the book. So he's almost twice as old as any other character in the book. And we learn that he's a Vietnam vet. However, none of those experiences are described, really, what mm-hmm. happened in Vietnam. But it certainly seems to inform his character quite a bit. I don't know if that was part of the stuff that you took out, was Fetzer's memories of Vietnam. But it meant something to me to know that. And then there was a lot that, of course, was not written and expressed in the book, and I just kind of filled that in on my own.
Yeah, that's really great, because that's exactly what happened. I did have more about, I didn't write about specific Vietnam experiences for Fetzer, but I did give him
a little more backstory.
He certainly had backstory around a child that he'd had, who is no longer in the book, and the reason why he'd gone to Vietnam had to do with the breakup of the relate, you know, blah blah blah. And then I gave him some PTSD, which is not really in the story anymore, but it was part of like what happened in the household. But I was quite conscious of trying to weave tiny, tiny snippets of the Vietnam War and the aftermath of that war through the book, because I, at the time, I was feeling like, you know, the U.S. is getting into a quagmire with Iraq, just like it got into a quagmire with Vietnam. So we have Fetzer, who's the vet, and has these memories of things like how long it took for American citizens to start protesting the Vietnam War and how quickly they started protesting the Iraq War. He notices among the homeless people, he kind of picks up on which ones are vets, and he has this deep sympathy for them as people who are ongoing casualties of that war, you know, like not surviving the mental health repercussions of that war. And then, of course, there's Mr. Nguyen, the Vietnam refugee who runs the diner that they all go to, and so on. So I kept trying to thread little bits of just touches of Vietnam through the entire novel, just as a sense of like, just trying to give a sense of like, this is how things play out over a generation. You know, all of these millions of people get affected in these really negative ways, even after a war is declared over.
And kind of like the Vietnam War, I mean, the early protests seemed almost futile. You were going against the majority of the country and the state, Johnson, later Nixon. But ultimately, you could look at the protests as successful. Of course, we didn't know that quite during the Iraq invasion, but that's something that Fetzer could have informed him, where he knew, you know, patience might pay off at some point.
Yeah. I think he starts out with the protest having this sort of almost ebullient sense of like so much protesting is happening so quickly, it's going to have an effect, because he remembers the effect of the protests, you know, against Vietnam. And of course, it has no effect whatsoever. And so this adds to the sense of unease and I don't want to say apathy, but just like disillusionment, you know, the fact that these protests happened worldwide, millions and millions of people, and authorities paid no attention, and they were even downplayed by the media. You know, whereas in Vietnam, during the Vietnam time, the media gave a lot more airtime to that kind of stuff, and it gave airtime to actually, you know, the voices of the protesters and so on. And so it's a little bit of a portrait of how that landscape changed.
Oh yes, the media's changed considerably. There was no Fox News there. There were three networks, and the anchors I remember were somewhat trusted: the Walter Cronkites, the Huntley Brinkleys, and now I don't think there's one news person I trust. You know, they're all telling the story from their own point of view, much like the book is written.
Yeah.
Talking about media, the three main characters, so Nelson, Jen, and Fetzer, and their Omnia Mundi environmental activist group, they also have a talk show, a radio talk show on a somewhat fictionalized KABU, where you worked. You volunteered about 2002 to 2003. I was wondering exactly what you did there on KABU, and how your experiences there played a part in the novel, this fictional radio station and this fictional talk show, public affairs show.
Yeah. Well, my experience at KABU played a big part. You know, it was a really big source for all those community radio station details where the crew do their monthly show. I volunteered in the newsroom one half day a week in 2002 and 2003. And I think my title was like reporter or something. And I remember I would gather news and then rewrite it for radio, and, you know, got trained on using the equipment. And I think there were various, I think sometimes I would even pre-record bits and pieces. I also was teaching at the time. I used to teach at the Pacific Northwest College of Art, and I was teaching a media studies class. And I would take my class to KABU to spend a day, like a sort of like a field trip, to research and like collaboratively research and produce a story. So they got a little bit of a taste of community radio and so on. So, I really enjoyed my time at KABU there. It was hard work. And I was acutely aware of what was going on in the mainstream and alternative medias at the time, and the huge gap between them, and you know how the build up to war was being presented and discussed. And so I went to KBOO to try and sort of like do my part. That was like one place where I felt like I could do something useful. And so yeah, a lot of those details made it in there. I ended up taking out some of the technical details because over time I started to forget what they meant, and I realized I couldn't remember what they meant, then a reader wouldn't know what they meant. There was some machine, I don't know if you still have it at KBOO, called the Instant Replay.
Oh, and yes, we just call it the IR player.
Uh-huh. The IR player, okay, right. Yeah. And I think at some point Jen, you know, she's the engineer of the show, and she's talking about, like, she's grumbling about the Instant Replay or something. I took that out because I was like, I can't really remember what the Instant Replay was.
I gotta tell you, Julie, I never even knew what the IR stood for in IR players. Now I know it's used mostly all the promos are uh-huh. Queued up there. So usually when a DJ has a show for an hour, they're instructed to play two of those promos, and they have codes, three numbered codes, three
exactly.
digit codes,
yep.
And mm-hmm. They play it from this IR player, which now is a computer. I think in the old days it was probably tape cartridges. Maybe that's where it came from.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, and I think the queuing up aspect of it is the instant, you know, like you have it queued up, you punch in the number, and then it just, whatever you have queued up
right.
comes out over the air, yeah, yeah.
Now, besides that KBOO-like radio station in the book, there's also quite a bit of local color because it takes place in Portland at that time, 2002, and you mix real locations with the fictional. A major plot point involves a fictional college called Harry Lane University, and it's described as a progressive liberal arts school, which makes you think of Reed College. But I think you go out of your way to use a composite there, a little bit of Reed, a little bit of Portland State, maybe some other institutions of higher learning. So why'd you choose to go with a fictional college rather than an actual school like a Reed?
Well, what happens at the college is negative, and I mean some of it's positive, but the part it's a big subplot. The I guess you could say sort of the thriller. I'm using air quotes. You can't see, but like the thriller. I wouldn't say I wrote a thriller, but there's sort of like thrillerish aspects to the story revolve around the main characters uncovering fraud and corruption at this local college. And I didn't want to seem like I was maligning any local institution in that regard. I didn't want it to seem like I was possibly painting any of the colleges here in a bad light, like as if, you know, that kind of thing could happen at Reed or could happen at PSU or something. So I did go out of my way to make it a composite. It's kind of like Reed, it's private liberal arts and sciences, but it's set downtown, kind of like Portland State. And yeah, I really tried to make it not any one thing, because I didn't want it to seem like I was taking a dig at any institution.
Yeah, actually, without giving too much away, it's something that happens, I'm sure, not necessarily at Reed, but at Harvard, MIT, Stanford. I mean, without a doubt.
Yeah.
So it certainly didn't strain credibility there.
It's definitely the kind of thing that happened at that college is definitely something that does happen. So yeah, thanks for pointing that out.
Now, yeah. I'm curious about the book's title, Parts Per Million. The term itself refers to the way environmental pollutants are measured, you know, in the water, the air. So parts per million, it seems like a very small amount, you know, several parts per millions of parts. But even those, that measurement, even a few parts per million, can have a very damaging effect on the air we breathe and the water we drink. And of course, the book has this environmental theme about the activists. So that's a strong connection. But were there other reasons that went into choosing that particular title?
Yeah, well, it's definitely that reason that you mentioned. And there's also, I also thought it was a good metaphor for the idea of change in a society can start with a very small number of people. And I think somewhere in the novel, Jen alludes to this. She talks about like this is only something that the 0.0000, I forget how many zeros are in it, you know, 1% of people care about or do anything about or something. Just the idea that change can start with a very small number, and it can have an effect. So there's kind of the negative effect of, you know, the environmental pollutant side of the phrase parts per million, but there's also a positive notion to this as well of like, you know, we can start small and grow from there.
Kind of the 12 monkeys approach, I think, when an idea or supporters reach a critical mass, it just becomes de facto at a certain point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now the book features several illustrations by an artist, Gabriel Liston.
Yes.
And he was a student in a class that you taught on art and ideas. And the art in the book that you actually included, a lot of them are portraits of the three main characters, and along with several scenes from the book. And of course, given your work as a visual artist, it seemed like a natural collaboration. How'd you go about working with Gabriel on the drawings?
I think at some point I had this. This is before Laura at Forest Avenue Press acquired the manuscript. I had this idea that I would love to have the book illustrated. And I had this idea that there would be an illustration for each chapter. And there's 80 chapters, so that's actually, you know, a lot of illustrations. And I think I've just always liked illustrations in adult novels, and it's something that happened, you know, like around 100 years ago. You find old novels from the, you know, early 20th century, and they might have a handful of illustrations in them. And
Alice in Wonderland is a good example of that.
Well, that's very highly illustrated.
Yes.
And there's something about having those illustrations that I think is quite magical. There's a point of view that says, oh, you know, like, you don't want to add in illustrations because then you're just like making things too, you know, you don't let people rely on their imaginations. But I tend to feel that if there are a few illustrations, it can give readers a hook, something to hook onto that makes it then maybe easier to imagine a lot of other things in the novel.
Oh, I appreciated seeing the portraits of the characters. That helped a lot. I should mention you had a real strong precedent here. Your workshop teacher, Stephen Allred, his first novel was actually the first work of fiction published by your publisher, Forest Avenue Press, and Laura Stanfill, A Simplified Map of the World, and that had illustrations.
Yeah.
Along with his most recent novel, which came out last year.
Exactly. Yeah. Forest Avenue Press really enjoys illustrations and novels. And I think there are a few that have come out of Forest Avenue that have illustrations. And so it was definitely not, you know, a crazy new thing or anything, because Laura really feels the same way about illustrations, how much they can enrich a novel without having to turn it into a graphic novel. A lot of people who read the book, the manuscript, said, oh, you should turn this into a graphic novel. It's very visual. It's very filmic. It's, you know, like, it's very, it, like, people like would have a very strong sense of, you know, like seeing the novel play out as they were reading it. And while I think that's a fantastic idea, I feel like graphic novels are a whole nother skill set, you know, that...
Oh, I agree.
I don't have, yeah. You know, I'm not a graphic novelist. And well, if someone wants to turn this into a graphic novel, let's chat. But that's not something that I felt I could do justice to. But adding a few illustrations in was like the level at which I could manage that. And so, yeah, it was a very fun collaboration working with Gabriel. I chose Gabriel because I knew he had skills, not just in drawing the figure. And, you know, not every contemporary artist has skills in drawing the figure. It's not something that is as mandatory in art education as it was, you know, several generations ago. And so he has these amazing skills in drawing the figure, and he also has skills in drawing from his imagination. And that's what I needed. I needed a realist who could draw the figure realistically and also draw from his imagination, because there's no pictures. You know, I didn't have like snapshots to show him. He had to read the novel and imagine things and then draw what he was imagining. And so we collaborated on that, because sometimes he'd draw something and I'd be like, no, actually she's not next to him in this scene. You know, she's on the other side of the room or something. And he'd go back and be like, oh yeah, you're right. And so we would go back and forth in that kind of, on that level of detail.
And I want to mention to listeners too, that even though you didn't include all his illustrations in the book, people can view them. You have several websites for the book and your own work, and there's one called omniamundi.org, and Gabriel's illustrations, quite a few, at least 20 or 30, are available there to browse on the web.
Yeah, there's a lot on there, because he filled two whole notebooks with studies.
Wow.
I know. It was just so many studies. And I, you know, as the person who wrote the book, having someone else bring to life what you've written down only as words, it was magical. It was so magical watching him draw, you know, what he imagined, and seeing how often the way he was imagining things was like the way I was imagining things. You know, like, oh my God, you got it. That's amazing. So that was really fantastic. So yeah, omniamundi.org. That's actually the URL of the characters in the book. Like, they have the radio show,
right,
but they also have
their own media group.
I know. I was like able to grab that URL, which was really great. And so it's not their website, but because their website's full of, you know, information about environmental stuff, but it's full of the illustrations. Yeah.
Now I saved this question for last, and I have to ask. The novel's a snapshot of that particular time in recent American history. So, as we mentioned, just after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, people remember back that far the demonization of Muslims, people from the Middle East, the Iraq invasion, the weapons of mass destruction mythology, the 2002 midterm elections. So November of that year, when Republicans won the Senate, they already had the House. They extended their majority. You had George W. Bush in the White House. And you even mention Donald Trump in the book as a jokey aside by one of the characters.
Yeah.
And as bad as all that was, you know, we lived through it. It seems almost tame compared with what we're going through now, with the corruption and incompetence of that Donald Trump in the White House, which has led to a current state of fear, the financial anxiety we first talked about when we sat down here, our unpreparedness for the coronavirus pandemic. Now, you started the book in 2002. What did you feel as you were making revisions? And I think up until the book was published, so maybe was that after the 2016 election?
The book was published. The book was acquired before the election. It was acquired in the summer of 2016, but then it was published in 2018. Just because it was a very long process towards, you know, publication in the world of fiction. I totally agree. I feel like, and this is something that struck me when you know, if you remember November 9th, 2016, the day after the election, a lot of people who didn't expect Trump to get in were absolutely devastated.
Devastated, you know,
it was just,
yes.
It was just
the right word.
The shocking, it was like the worst thing that could have happened, and unbelievable, and so on.
And we weren't wrong.
and we weren't wrong, exactly. And so when Laura at Forest Avenue acquired the manuscript, she acquired it because she loved the characters. She wanted a realistic novel set in the recent past. She thought the activism thing was interesting, because there were, you know, there had been quite a bit of activism happening in the prior year or two, you know, around Black Lives Matter and so on. And so she, to her, it was like almost like a, not a historical novel exactly, but, you know, she just felt like it was a novel with it's a very character-driven novel, even though it's historically, you know, set in a very specific time. It's very character-driven, and that's why she acquired it. And so we sort of really had no idea that it would suddenly become relevant in that way. You know, I think a lot of people thought that the Bush administration and that sort of giddy slide into fascism and you know, warmongering and just total information awareness and, you know, Operation Tips and the Homeland Security, you know, just all that
Patriot Act.
Establishment of the Patriot Act, the surveillance state and everything was some sort of aberration that would sort of eventually sort of boil off. And then suddenly, no, we're back in that crazy time. And so suddenly the novel became really relevant on, you know, not just like an interesting novel about some interesting people, but really relevant to. And so that's something that, you know, I think a lot of us are feeling a very deep sense of loss and have been for a few years now, culturally, socially, personally, and that loss is just ratcheted up now with the coronavirus, you know, causing people to lose their livelihoods and their ability to even just like be with each other and so on. And so we're undergoing some really challenging societal transformations, and we're not through it, you know, we're in the middle of it. And the characters in the novel, they go through loss and they go through transformation, particularly Nelson. So at the time, you know, when I was writing it, I felt like it was a metaphor for something larger. And another thing that I think is really relevant in the novel that's relevant today is, on the left, I think we're often fighting among ourselves. Right at the time when we need to come together and create a cohesive movement in resistance to the, you know, in capital letters, bad things that are happening. And so like the characters in Parts Per Million, they sort of start to split apart under pressure, but they get through it. And I really hope on a larger scale, so will we all. Even though the novel has sad things in it and so on, it does end on a hopeful note. And people who've read the novel tell me that it's inspiring for them. So I hope that it can be like a, you know, a small beacon of hope around the possibility of transformation, the possibility, you know, the fact that the potential is always there. And I think Nelson is a metaphor for potential in that regard.
Well, Julia, that's a good way to end on that note of hope and optimism, and I feel the same way. Again, thanks so much for joining us today under these very odd conditions, you know, where we're doing this at Skype. I'm at home, you're at home. Please stay healthy and safe.
Thanks, Ken.
Well, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big neighborhood thank you to Julia Stoops for joining us through the magic of Skype. You can find out more about Julia's work at juliastoops.com, and you can order a copy of Julia's novel Parts Per Million from your favorite independent bookstore. These local businesses are struggling right now during the coronavirus shutdown, but many of them can ship, or in some cases even deliver the book right to your doorstep. Just a note that Mr. Jones's Neighborhood will now be coming to you monthly on every fourth Friday from 11 a.m. to noon. Tune in for our next show on Friday, April 24th at 11 a.m. when our guest will be Oregon-born blues guitarist and songwriter and one of our favorite guests on the show, Ty Curtis. Hope to see you all again then. In the meantime, many thanks to the KABU staff, Jenna, Celeste, Arthur, Tammy, Asia, Althea, and others who are keeping the station running while almost everyone else at the station is keeping their distance and making radio from home. And many thanks to all of you as well for listening. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying may there be better and more beautiful days ahead.